Canada's official position is that settlements are unlawful. Canada's Foreign Affairs Canada's website has stated for years that Israeli settlements are in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Therefore, they are a grave breach. Article 49.6, a war crime under the protocol additional, and an obstacle above all that to a two-state solution, which Canada has always embraced. And yet Canada end Canadian involvement in illegal Israeli settlements. Canada actually extends aid and assistance to the settlements, doesn't it?
Yes, and Canada also allows into Canada products that are manufactured in those illegal settlements.
It actually unbelievably extends favorable tariff treatment to those settlement products under the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement. And I know a little bit about this. As you know, I won't go into the whole full disclosure here, but I know for a fact that Canadian trade officials told the federal government years ago that the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement really doesn't cover settlements.
Those David Kattenberg's Green Planet Monitor. Find the archives at greenplanetmonitor.net, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Harbinger Executive Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, policy analyst Steve Staples and host Desmond Cole explain why Prime Minister Carney's historic military spending hike is really probably only going to benefit the weapons lobby. Now, here's Desmond.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. Since their election victory in April, the federal Liberals have ramped up military spending to record levels, with Prime Minister Mark Carney openly admitting that there will be what he calls trade-offs down the road in order to pay for this new military spending. Carney wants to crank up military spending to 5% of Canada's annual gross domestic product, or GDP, and to put that into real numbers, it's $150 billion per year, raising the specter of deep cuts to other federal services and programs. To talk about all this, I'm joined today by Steve Staples. He is a policy analyst and frequent commentator on defense and military policy, a longtime peace activist, and the author of Missile Defense Round One, a book about the fight to stop Canadian participation in George W. Bush's anti-cruise missile defense system. And Steve's currently the director of research and advocacy at the Canadian Health Coalition. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Desmond.
Thanks so much for joining us. So to begin, could you please walk us through how big of a shift this Carney proposal for 5% of GDP spending is for Canada's military policy? Like, how does this new 5% benchmark compare to military spending in the past?
Well, it's almost difficult to describe, Desmond. It's so big. I mean, this is completely uncharted territory. I think you'd have to go back to the Second World War. And even then, I'm not sure if we spent this much. This is certainly surpassing Cold War era spending. And it's hard to imagine what it is our budget is even going to look like by the end of it, and if it's even possible for them to spend this much money. As you know, it was Harper that agreed to the 2% GDP mark about a decade ago or so that NATO put out, that all of the members of NATO should be putting in money into the collective defense of the military alliance in kind of equal proportion. And so they calculated that based on a percentage of GDP, so that big countries would be putting in a lot of money, smaller countries would be putting in smaller amounts, but based on the size of their economy, it would be kind of shared out. And even Harper never achieved that level of spending. And then now we've got Carney coming in, promising to hit 2% of GDP, which is tens of billions of dollars more. We roughly now we spend, I think it's around roughly 30 or 40 billion on defense right now, or certainly soon will be, just to get up to the 2%. So now the benchmark has moved again to 3.5% GDP for national defense, plus another 1.5% that will be a little more open to include things like infrastructure and things like that that you might consider part of your national security framework. So certainly 3.5 for defense, and then another 1.5% GDP on critical infrastructure gets you up to 5%. The Prime Minister himself, speaking in Europe just yesterday, said it's going to quadruple our defense spending by 2030, which is just around the corner. I mean, that's only 4 or 5 more years from now. So we're going to see a wholesale transformation of Canadian military spending beyond what any prime minister has done in a few generations.
I think you make a good point that we might take this with a grain of salt because previous prime ministers have made promises on NATO spending and haven't gotten close to it. So fair to say, but there's been a lot of pressure on Canada recently to increase that NATO spending. We know that Trump has been pressuring Canada a lot to get to this 5%. He's been complaining that Canada and many other countries around the world are not paying their fair share when it comes to NATO commitments. But who really stands to benefit, Steve, from this increased proposed spending that Carney is talking about?
Well, there's a couple of very powerful lobbies in Canada that have come together now. And it isn't the first time. We've seen this before. You mentioned the book I did back around the turn of the century, 2006, right after 9/11, and the Canadian-U.S. border was closed for a number of days. We saw a coming together of the corporate lobby that really wants to have free trade and free movement of goods and low government regulations and low taxes, along with the defense lobby, this other kind of subset of it, of defense companies, and they're allied with retired military generals and, of course, all the people in the military establishment itself. And now we're seeing it again with Trump. So we're seeing the people that want to maintain access to the U.S. market, who don't want to see these tariffs come in, that want to see CUSMA, and which is the modern version of free trade, maintained. So they think that by teaming up with the defense lobby, all the companies that build the weapons, of which is substantial, most of which are actually American-owned, some European-owned. There's a small portion that are Canadian, but by and large, it's a branch plant economy in Canada. So these two lobbies come together with a shared interest to try to get military spending up as high as it can to appease the United States in the hopes, in the vague hopes, that this creates some sort of environment where we can keep our preferred trading relationship with the United States going. So this massive defense spending, it's not really about protecting Canada. It's about protecting free trade. That's what it's all about.
So you kind of led right into my next question, because we've got a prime minister with the desire to earmark this money. We've got industries in Canada that are eager to see this money being spent. But what I haven't heard clearly articulated, Steve, is like, what's the threat? Where are these supposed serious threats to Canadian security coming from? Do they even exist in your view? And if so, how serious are they?
Well, you're quite right, Desmond, that when we look at, say, other countries, our opponents, perhaps, we would say that their defense spending has to be based on some consideration of what threats they have against them. But we don't seem to be applying that in our case. Of course, they're looking at Russia and the Ukraine war. I think that has been a major factor in terms of strengthening the arguments to spend more on defense, to try to deter Russia from further expanding. So, but there's also other elements as well, too. Carney's not just using it for defense. He wants to develop the economy using this. So he sees this as part of a larger industrial strategy to promote manufacturing, high tech, AI type applications and things, which is going to come through a lot of defense spending, and is really where AI is being pioneered to a large degree is in the defense environment. So it's kind of a kickstart to the whole economy. But the threat is just not present. I don't think people sort of think that Russia is going to invade Canada or anything like that. If anything, you know, people would now say that, well, gosh, the real threat, the only people really threatening us in a way is the United States. And there's just no way you could spend enough to defend Canada militarily from the United States behemoth. So the threats aren't really there, and they're not even really bothering to try to articulate to Canada, to Canadians, that this defense spending is to keep us safe. It's just really all about job creation and pivoting to the Europe to try to get more investment there, and quite clearly about an agreement with the United States. You know, Carney, during the election, he said, I want a new deal, a commercial and security agreement with the United States. Well, that's quite unusual, Desmond, because normally you don't link those two issues together. They are treated separately. You don't want to have your defense policy involved in your broader economic policy, because you would never want to have spending on weapons and things like that tied to some other commercial project that you've got with a trading neighbor. They don't really come together, and that was quite new with Carney putting those two together in such a stark way, as if this is part of some bargain that we're going to have with the United States, that if we build up our defense spending, we'll somehow grease the gears for a better deal with the U.S. So he's been quite upfront with it.
There seemed to be a perception among Canadians that we do need more protection in the form of military spending. There was an, I think, Ipsos poll that said 70%, about 70% of Canadians think we should have a bigger military budget. And in the recent election campaign that we had this spring, every major party except for the Green Party promised that they would increase military spending. So something is going on here to push certainly the political class, but also a significant number of Canadians to feel like we seemingly need this.
You got it. The defense lobby has really seemed to have captured almost all the political parties, with give the exception to the Greens, and hats off to them. But any of the other political parties, including the NDP, have long held a position of increasing military spending. The defense lobby has, for many years, downplayed the size of the Canadian defense budget. We're actually, in terms of real dollars, actual dollars, not percentage of GDP, but how much money you're putting on the table, we're like seventh highest in NATO. We're in the top 20 globally, and the only guys that spend more than us have nuclear weapons. You know, within NATO, that's the top tier, and we're right there, right underneath it in terms of actual dollars that we spend. So that's a large contribution, and it's been going up. Each party has put it up. The Liberals increased it under Paul Martin. Then we had Harper, who promised to keep the boosts that Paul Martin Liberals had. He's going to continue to boost it. It's continued to go up year after year. And in fact, the Department of National Defense has had a hard time even spending it all. They actually end up leaving it on the table because they can't possibly spend that much money in such a short period of time. And now here comes Carney. He's doing it on steroids and boosting it on steroids. So it's the same military. I still don't see how they're going to be able to spend all that money without wasting great gobs of cash. So I think that we've got a real problem here. And then politically, all the parties have moved forward. The NDP in particular often chose defense critics who had large military bases in their own ridings. And so they had a natural tendency to be pro more spending because that was meeting the interests of their own constituents, whether it was on the East Coast or the West Coast in recent times. They saw it as a form of job creation. So there was other aspects of that, and the party has not been really great in Canada generally hasn't been really great on foreign policy in any way, but the compulsion to spend more on defense really is all-consuming in Ottawa. And it was, I spent 20 years in Ottawa at the Rideau Institute and other organizations arguing for lower defense spending, more reasonable defense spending based on our actual security needs. And I gotta tell you, Desmond, it felt pretty lonely some days.
That was a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcast at harbingermedianetwork.com, and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. And finally, broadcasting since 2020, The End of Sport provides commentary, analysis, and interviews reimagining sport, society, and sporting cultures with academics Derek Silva in London, Joanna Mellis in Philadelphia, and Nathan Coleman Lamb in Fredericton. On this excerpt from a new episode, hockey scholar Christy Alang joins Dr. Lamb to break down how to understand the Hockey Canada trial and its implications for the sport and Canadian culture. Now, here's the show.
You're listening to the End of Sport podcast, a podcast about harm, labor, and inequality in capitalist sport with your hosts, Joanna Mellis, Nathan Coleman Lamb, and Derek Silva. The End of Sport podcast is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, your left podcast community. Find us in great company with over 60 other shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. And as always, if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform, and please leave us a 5-star review, as those always help us reach a wider audience. Thanks for tuning in, and enjoy this episode of The End of Sport.
This fall and winter, Derek and I are going to be embarking on the kind of tour for the end of college football that we couldn't have because it was denied to us by the U.S. government, who have essentially prohibited our entry into the country. We would dearly love to see all of our U.S. friends at local locations. We won't be able to do that. However, we will remotely be at the Ohio State University on September the 8th. Being hosted by the Sport and Society Initiative. That event is a Zoom event that is taking place at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and one can register for that in advance through their website. We will also be in Toronto, Ontario, Canada on September the 18th, 6 p.m. at Hart House for an event we're incredibly excited about with our friend Daniel Salofsky, who will also be talking about his new book, Playing Through Pain. And we're going to be in conversation with the tremendous sports journalist Morgan Campbell. So we're really excited about that event in September in Toronto. We will also be in Vancouver in November, in advance of the North American Society for the Sociology of Sport Conference. We will be at Simon Fraser University on November 5th. And then we have dates that we have not yet scheduled but are intending in Ottawa and Montreal in the winter, hopefully March. So please look out for the announcement of those. Hi, friends, and welcome to another episode of the End of Sport podcast. My name is Nathan Coleman Lamb, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by my friend Christy Alang, one of really the world's most distinguished scholars of hockey generally, to talk about an issue that I think we would rather not have to be talking about, but one that should be really forefront in the minds of anyone who cares about hockey in Canada, and that is the recently resolved Hockey Canada trial related to the sexual violence case in London, Ontario, with the World Juniors team. And what Christy does, which I think is so helpful in this conversation, is rather than getting into the weeds sort of about the details of the legal dimensions of the case and whether the verdict is quote-unquote right or quote-unquote wrong, it's really to try to think about the implications of this trial for hockey culture in Canada and Canadian culture more broadly, and sort of where we go from here, what the implications are, and sort of how it all fits together. So without any further ado, I will turn it over now to Christy. Christy Elaine is Canada Research Chair in Physical Culture and Social Life at St. Thomas University, where she is Associate Professor of Sociology. And frankly, she is one of Canada's foremost authorities on the study of hockey culture. And that's why she's on the show today. Christy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, of course, like, you have the distinct displeasure of basically constantly being invited onto things to talk about just the worst topics, things that are, you know, painful to consider. And unfortunately, that's really what we've done again here. We had you on previously. I hope folks have listened to that episode. You should, if you have not. It provides plenty of context for the conversation we're going to have today. It's a larger discussion about myriad problems with Canada's hockey culture, because there's not just one such problem, but certainly one of those most salient problems is the one that we're returning to today, which has to do with the question of gender-based violence, sexual violence, and Canada's most beloved national pastime. So what I want to do to begin with here, for those who have not been following, and I know that many of you listeners have been following and you know exactly what's going on, but I think some will not, and it's really important for us to get into the biggest of big questions, which is the history and context to this Hockey Canada trial that has just completed. What is the incident in question, and how has it shaped discourse and policy around hockey in Canada in the last few years prior to the trial itself and verdict?
Well, I mean, there's a huge context to this story. I think for a lot of Canadians, it felt like it kind of came out of nowhere that we, you know, in 2022, Rick Westhead broke a story that there was alleged gang rape against a woman that we've come to know as EM in London, Ontario, after a celebratory golf weekend, or in the midst of a celebratory golf weekend, by the 2018 World Junior Hockey Championship winning team. But of course, this is tied and connected to other instances of sexual violence. It was in short order that we had heard that there was a video circulating amongst the media of another alleged gang rape of an unconscious woman in Halifax in 2003 during the World Junior Hockey Championships by members of the Hockey Canada team. We haven't seen any charges or any more information about that. It also came on the back of things like Laura Robinson, an important Canadian journalist, reports in the mid-90s of a whole slew of sexual violence, including hazing instances, rape, convictions, and the ways that teams had bent over backwards sometimes to allow players who probably shouldn't have been on the ice or may have been a threat to their community to participate unbeknownst to many in the communities of which they were living. I'm thinking about the Jared Reed situation in particular here. So what's interesting, I think, about the 2022 case is that it came at a time where we had other things happening in Canada. It came, you know, on the heels of a Me Too movement where people were demanding that women not be assaulted. It came on the heels of a 2020 lawsuit launched by Dan Carcillo and company alleging a history of sexual violence in the Canadian Hockey League, in the form of hazing, that there was a systemic problem of sexual violence, player to player, staff to player, coach to player. And although this lawsuit wasn't certified, the justice had some pretty damning words, I think, for the CHL, and actually suggested ways for Carcillo and company to bring forward lawsuits, suggested that bullying and harassment and a code of silence were endemic to the Canadian Hockey League, and that these were facilitated, these kinds of acts of sexual violence, which were characterized as grotesque, were facilitated by employees and team staff, and that this was particularly troubling given the young age of the players, who are often, you know, taken from their homes and who are laboring really as professionals, as child workers from the time they are as young as 16 years old into their early 20s. So I think, and not to mention, not to forget the alarming situation, the Kyle Beach situation, which is also happening just before the Rick Westhead broke the story of EM. He also broke the story of Kyle Beach. Kyle Beach was sexually assaulted by a member of the Chicago Blackhawks staff, and the resulting cover-up by Joe Quimble, Stan Bowman, and other prominent members of what we would call, you know, hockey royalty. The NHL suspended Quimble and Bowman, but was quick to reinstate them when there seemed to be a desire, you know, when the hype around the situation was gone and there seemed to be a desire to bring them back and seemed profitable for the NHL to do so. So what I think is so interesting about EM's complaint and the lawsuit that resulted was that what it did that I think is so important, regardless of the verdict, this case was always about more than the verdict. It was about a really important moment in Canadian culture where people were demanding a kind of change. Where we had moved, and I think for me as a sociologist and somebody who's really interested in meaningful change, we saw a movement from talking about this as the problem of a couple of bad apples or a few bad actors to being an actual systemic problem, that there was something not right about young men and boys' hockey culture in Canada, and a demand by myriad members of the public, the state, and sporting institutions, sponsors, capitalist sports didn't want to be tied to Canada's most important brand, its most important sporting brand, being Hockey Canada. We saw, you know, lots of sponsors cut and run, and many forever. Some didn't come back, some have come back. We saw the state call Hockey Canada to account, and not just to account for the allegations of sexual assault and the resulting cover-up, which was that Hockey Canada settled the case with EM, saddling her with a non-disclosure agreement, which they subsequently lifted. But they settled the case without the knowledge of even the players involved, which was highly, highly unusual. They did so using a fund called the National Equity Fund, which, if we take that at its word, seems like a surprising place to be settling lawsuits like this that had nothing to do with equity, but actually have to do with gender-based violence and sexual violence. It seems deceptive. And the Canadian government had real questions. We found that they weren't keeping board minutes. They weren't being transparent.
Excerpt from a new episode of The End of Sport. Find the 166 episode archive wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now on Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of more than 80 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada.